Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along. We learn more about the upcoming season at MSU's Wharton Center later this hour. We also learn about young people aging out of our state's foster care system and the many challenges that they face. Frank Ochberg is a name that's probably familiar to you as well. He is an MSU expert, a much sought-after guy, involving trauma and traumatic stress in kidnapping situations. He has been at this kind of work for a long, long time, and we look forward to a chat with Frank later this hour here on Current State. At the top, Michigan's long contentious debate over Medicaid expansion appears to be over. The Michigan House passed a measure late yesterday, and Governor Rick Snyder says he looks forward to signing it. In the meantime, the state will continue to negotiate with the federal government on particular waivers involved in the program. Now, Jim Haveman is the director of the Michigan Department of Community Health. He says that should not be a problem.
You know, the federal government really wants Michigan to be part of this, and I think they're going to move this waiver along as fast as they can. They have certain benchmarks and timelines that they got to follow, but they're partnering with us on this.
And for now, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta joins us this morning to explain what happened yesterday, its importance, and what lay ahead. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
Remind us what these waivers involve exactly.
These were conditions that the Republicans who lead the legislature said that they were not going to just go along with the Medicare expansion as it was outlined by the federal government, that they wanted to put some conditions in there. And so these are the conditions first put in by the House and then sort of amplified by the Senate action. And in general terms, it would require people who are in the Medicaid expansion program to have health savings accounts, and those would be funded through a variety of mechanisms, co-pays that they would have to pay when they go and receive services. And then over the longer term, that there would be incentives, reduced co-pays, things like that, for adopting healthy behaviors, making sure that you show up regularly for checkups, following doctor's orders, not doing unhealthy things like smoking, controlling weight, that sort of stuff. So there are also these incentives for what they're calling healthy behaviors, and the idea is that this is not just an expansion of the Medicaid program as it exists to take in more working poor people who don't have coverage, but to also make some pretty dramatic changes to the program to try and encourage people not just to get medical care, but to get medical care and be healthier as a result.
And Mr. Haveman basically sounds pretty confident for his part, at least at this point.
Well, think about it this way, that about half the states have adopted the Medicaid expansion, that the Obama administration has big targets that they have to hit if the federal health care reforms are going to succeed and if the Medicaid expansion, which is central to it, is going to succeed. As a matter of fact, yesterday, when this bill was in the Senate getting ready to go over to the House, I saw a guy who looked an awful lot like Barack Obama actually taking the legislation and walking it over. That's a joke, Mark. The administration is very the federal administration, the Obama administration, has a lot at stake in this Medicaid expansion as well. And so there's a sense that no matter how dire things may have appeared because of the looming timelines and deadlines, that they are going to be extremely cooperative in trying to get this done.
There is the issue of the delayed implementation and the federal dollars that are also in play. Can you help us understand the from 5 miles up, what are the big forces in play there?
Well, okay. Well, let's start with the money that Michigan loses, that the state was counting on transferring some services that currently Michigan taxpayers pay for over to the Medicaid program and paying for it with federal dollars. That's lost money. It's about $63, $64 million. The biggest chunk of it is mental health services for prison inmates. Then there's the money that Michigan just won't get in federal Medicaid subsidies. And if you're one of those people who sort of keeps track of how much money Michigan sends to Washington versus how much we get back, Michigan is still a donor state, and that would have been an opportunity to even the score a little bit. The number that the administration has been using, although they may be walking that back a little, was $7 million a day. It's about $630 million if you add it all up over the total period of time of roughly 3 months that the enactment of the Medicaid expansion will be delayed.
Okay.
And just to explain that quickly, and that's because there's actually a process, a procedural motion that would have allowed the Medicaid program to take effect January 1st. Because that didn't happen, it has to wait until 3 months after the end of the legislative session, which puts it into, you know, probably late March.
How do the Republicans who in the end delayed the implementation, how do they explain the expansion, their support for the expansion, but not the immediate?
There's no one who supported the expansion who was opposed to the earlier enactment of it. The problem is that particular motion, it's called immediate effect. It's in the state constitution because the framers back in the early 60s wanted to make sure that new laws weren't just foisted upon people and businesses without warning. And so what they said is no law will take effect until 90 days after the end of the legislative session when they adjourn for the year. And that'll give people time to, you know, learn about it, understand it, and prepare for it. There are some circumstances where you're not going to wait that long. And so what you can do is by super majorities, two-thirds majorities, the kinds of super majorities you need to, for example, put something on the ballot, then you can suspend that and put in an earlier enactment date, in this case, January 1st. What the Senate failed to do was get up to that super majority. The Medicaid expansion passed by a simple majority of 20 votes. They needed a two-thirds vote to do that. So that's why it didn't pass. There's no hypocrisy in play, at least on that particular question.
Okay, good. There is also a matter of fines that we stirred up here just before we came to air. Can you put that in some perspective for us?
Sure. That people who, under the Affordable Care Act, people who do not have insurance coverage will have to start paying fines. Like even in Michigan, we expect that roughly between the Medicaid expansion and people using federal subsidies and whatnot to buy coverage on the insurance exchange, we'll probably put 1 million more people on the rolls in Michigan. That's a significant number. The Snyder administration is still anticipating that about 200,000 people will decide that it's – for whatever reasons, maybe because they think it's in their economic self-interest or whatever, will decide to pay the fines rather than get coverage. For the people and the 320,000 people in the first year who are in that pool that would be eligible for the expanded Medicaid program, they don't really have that option. But they would still be subject to the fines that exist under the Affordable Care Act for not having coverage. Mm. They can't get it. So, you know, but there's no, you know, specific mechanism. Now, what it looks like the Obama administration, the IRS, are going to do is if people sign up during that initial sign-up period, and it'll go from I think October 1st to March 31st, people who sign up during that period, even if they don't have coverage until early spring, that we're anticipating that the IRS will simply forgive those fines, will waive them for people who sign up. So it's an issue. It's out there, but it's, you know, looking like that will get resolved, and we're not going to force working poor people to pay fines for coverage they can't get.
I'll also drop in here the current state. We'll have more on this whole sign-up procedure that launches October 1st on tomorrow's edition of the show. For now, we thank you, Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
current state on 90.5 WKAR. The last year has been a trying one for Lansing's Niowave Corporation and its residential neighbors in the area north of downtown. The Lansing Economic Area Partnership, or LEAP, has spent months forging an agreement between the company and its neighbors over how to improve the appearance of a large metal building that went up last summer. Irate residents launched a campaign called Fix the Facade that called for hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of design improvements to the structure, including landscaping, a new roof, windows, and more. Back in April, an apparent deal was struck that one of our next guests described the current state as imperfect but still acceptable to a majority of residents. It tied a Niowave tax abatement from the city to improvements. Yesterday, the plan's approval was formally announced. Niowave Chief Operating Officer Jerry Hollister says the redesign of the company's facility will be more aesthetically pleasing.
There's going to be a false facade added to the existing facility that's going to be a different color than the current blue and white. It's going to be more earth tones. And the roof will also be a different color. It'll be a greenish color. And then there's going to be landscaping added as well and some other surface work.
And here to tell us more now is Bob Trezise, who joined us back in April on Current State. The last time we talked about this, Bob is CEO of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, or LEAP.
Hi, Mark.
Welcome back, Bob. And Rena Risper is president of the Walnut Neighborhood Organization. Welcome back, Rena.
Thank you.
Back in April, Bob, you referred to this imperfect solution. You acknowledged that to this dispute over the appearance of the structure, but you said that the vast majority of Walnut residents agreed to it nonetheless. What was announced yesterday? That plan, or has the plan changed since you were here last time?
The plan has changed dramatically from April.
How?
Rena Risper and Dale Schrader, Mary Lane Keener, and other great leaders, and most of this story is about great leadership, let me say, Rena especially, kept driving us toward we need more solution. The roof was good. It was a good step. I do think that a lot of people enjoyed it. We changed some of the colors. We're beginning to think about brick, sort of a brick facade. But we weren't done with our work, and so we kept pressing forward. And we had great partners, again, in the Walnut Neighborhood Association and with Niowave. And that's one reason, Mark, in my judgment, this is a very refreshing and satisfying moment for me, I have to say, in economic development. This is one of the better moments in my 20 years, honestly, is seeing people who were really on different polarized points on this issue. And no one particularly at fault, but everyone being real interested in a dialogue and solution. And you have someone like Rena Risper who kept pushing and saying, we can get this done, keep it up, let's not quit, because there are many times I wanted to quit, honestly.
Was there a sticking point, Rena, from your perspective?
The sticking point was that we had the pole barn in our neighborhood and we wanted to have it fixed.
No, but was there a particular feature about the pole barn
that took months to work out? There wasn't any particular thing that took months and months to work out. I believe that just continually working with LEAP, Niowave, and the neighborhood is what made it go through. Sometimes when you're having these conversations between businesses and neighbors, I must say that media and politics get involved, and it doesn't pan out too well. So when you take those two things out, honestly, things move much faster.
See, if you could just eliminate the politics, then the media would just handle it all, and there wouldn't be any problems. Has the funding formula changed since April?
It has. Not for one thing, Niowave made some fairly substantial concessions in that they're way out of their budget now. Their budget that they held very firm to for a long time, they're putting well over $100,000 into the solution. And also the Lansing Brownfield Authority is going to put in over $100,000. It's just about a 50-50 match. And none of that money is taxpayer money, by the way. It's all money that developers contribute as part of their brownfield projects across the city. So I like this project, too, because it's, in a weird way, developers are assisting a neighborhood through their contributions to the brownfield program, their individual projects. So You know, Mark, I really have to tell you, I think NIAWAVE is a better company today because of this process.
What have they learned from this? Has this been instructive for the neighborhood and for NIAWAVE?
NIAWAVE is an awesome company. Definitely. I mean, they 7 years ago, they didn't exist. And they are exactly the poster child for a new Lansing, a new Michigan. I mean, they're high tech. They use retired GM workers, though, on machinery and equipment. I mean, but there is high tech of a company in their industry in the world, literally. And they embraced Walnut Neighborhood. And, you know, they made a real choice. They could have gone anywhere. They could have gone to a Greenfield site or somewhere else.
Did you feel embraced?
I did feel
Rena?
Embraced.
Okay.
Yes, we absolutely adore NIAWAVE being in our neighborhood. What we did not like was the aesthetics of the pole barn. And now that they're changing it and working together with us, we are absolutely fine with NIAWAVE. We wanted to be able to say that this community that's nestled in between Old Town and Downtown is a force to be reckoned with. We have really great neighbors. We live in a residential neighborhood where people can actually get everywhere they need to be within almost 15 minutes, with the exception of Okemos. I mean, it's a really great place. You can walk to Old Town, you can walk to Downtown, and not pay as high of a rent as you would in Old Town and Downtown. So, in essence, this whole situation really has just brought Walnut Neighborhood to a larger light, and also has shown that we are a viable force in the community.
As we've done in the past, Current State did ask NIAWAVE to join us for this discussion. They were unable to make anybody available. But, Bob, I've got to ask you, did LEAP end up doing work? Did you end up doing work that arguably should have been done by others here?
No, definitely not. I think this is exactly what LEAP is supposed to do. I mean, I felt some responsibility for this. I wasn't responsible, but, you know, on July 3rd, 2012, when we all arrived for the new press conference at the NIAWAVE building, that was the first time I saw it, and I did have, a bit of a start when I saw it. And I knew right then that this was going to be a big issue and was going to need to be resolved. Economic development is about helping people and bringing people together. And this is a real refreshing case of a neighborhood and a company. You know, it took 14 months, but it was a very healthy dialogue. I think everyone, honestly, not to be too corny about it, but across the country could take a lesson from what occurred between Walnut Neighborhood and NIAWAVE. This is how to get something done, a dialogue and finding a solution.
Is the path ahead clearer for the city, Rena, as far as similar type renovations in the future? I mean, the city council definitely plays a role in this.
Oh, most definitely. I think that when we started, our goals were very clear. And our first goal was to change the language so that this does not happen in any other neighborhood. And our second goal was to fix the facade. And I must say that given the large amount of changes that need to be made, we actually did very well for 14 months. I'm not going to complain about how long it actually took. There are people who are still in negotiations about changing issues with buildings for years, and ours really did not take that long. I'm going to take the positive road. And what I'd also like to say that I was actually very amazed at Mayor Bonero's input into this whole situation.
How so?
He was very instrumental in making sure that the money was there, or helping find the money to make sure this was done. And number one, he stayed out of the fray, which was most important.
He let us LEAP just get with the neighborhood, with NIAWAVE, and really work it hard. And I thought he showed amazing leadership.
That was very impressive to me.
In the end, how important was it that NIAWAVE wanted a tax break from the city? I mean, was that a significant factor in keeping NIAWAVE at the table and willing to consider improvements?
Well, it definitely gave the city an enormous amount of leverage, which is another good thing about incentives. I mean, they help grow businesses. They also are one of the limited ways a city can really have input and assist a company guide them toward the right decisions.
We've got just about 30 seconds or so. Bob, the work that NIOWAVE is involved in is extremely cutting edge. Give us your take on this incredible laser work that they do. Well, it's tied into U.S. defense system.
We're the accelerator region of the United States. No one else can say that. We have a company and now even more companies that are working with laser technologies that are absolute cutting edge. A lot of it is related to MSU's accelerator program and now the FRIB. And when we're still competing for the FRIB with other regions in the country for funding, pointing to a major private company that is utilizing and commercializing the technologies is a big advantage for our region when we're competing nationally for new technologies.
Bob Trezise is CEO of LEAP, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. He's been joined by Rena Risper, president of the Walnut Neighborhood Organization. Congratulations. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks a lot, Rena.
Thank you.
Time now for another Current State Public Poetry Announcement.
Visitor by Brenda Shaughnessy. I am dreaming of a house just like this one, but larger and opener to the trees, nighter than day and higher than noon, and you, visiting, knocking to get in, hoping for icy milk or hot tea or whatever it is you like. For each night is a long drink in a short glass, a drink of black sound water, such a rush and fall of lonesome, no form can contain it. And if it isn't night yet, though I seem to recall that it is, then it is not for everyone. Did you receive my invitation? It is not for everyone. Please come to my house lit by leaf light. It's like a book with bright pages filled with flocks and glens and groves, and overlooked by Pan, that seductive satyr in whom the fish is also cooked. A book that took too long to read, but minutes to unread, that is, to forget. Strange are the pages thus. Nothing but the hope of company. I made too much pie in expectation. I was hoping to sit with you in a treehouse, in a nightgown, in a real way. Did you receive my invitation? Written in haste, before leaf blinked out, before the idea fully formed? An idea like a storm cloud that does not spill or arrive, but moves silently in a direction. Like a dark book in a long life, with a vague hope in a woodhouse with an open door. Visitor by Brenda Shaughnessy. For Current State, I'm Stephanie Glazier.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Amid the headlines about kidnappings, school shootings, and the like, survivors share a common problem, that of psychological trauma and even post-traumatic stress. Our next guest is a pioneer in the field of helping victims of such events. Frank Ochberg is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Michigan State University. He has founded, headed, or been a part of a number of organizations dealing with PTSD, and he was head of the Michigan Department of Mental Health from 1979 to 1981. In addition, you've probably seen him on national TV talking about the challenges faced by trauma survivors. Frank Ochberg joins us now by phone. Thanks for joining us.
You are welcome. Glad to be here, Mark.
You were an expert witness in the recent trial of Ariel Castro, the Cleveland man who held three women and a child captive for years. And there has been word this morning that Castro killed himself in his cell overnight. I have to ask you, what effect do you think this news will have on the recovery of the women he victimized?
You know, this is exactly what I'm asking myself right now. And here are a few of my thoughts. I don't believe that they right away are going to feel gleeful or anything in the opposite direction. I'm a little concerned that two of them in particular, who I think have a strong case of Stockholm Syndrome, and Mark, we could talk about that a little bit later, they may feel sad. And that's, and then they may ask themselves why they're feeling sad. So there can be confusion. Were I their therapist, I'd want to surface that and be sure they're talking it out and are finding themselves at peace with themselves.
Do you know what kind of therapy these people, the women, are getting?
I know that it's being provided pro bono, free of care, and by skilled therapists who are associated with the Cleveland Clinic, and they are women. That much I know. As I said when I testified, I did not interview them directly. I did interview Castro's daughter for a little bit over an hour, and that's interesting, Mark. She was asking me, did my dad really love me? And I believe that she was raised with a dad who expressed love toward her and never was abusive. So he had within him the capacity to show tenderness, care, happiness. Now, I looked at a lot of, would you believe, home movies. They took movies inside that house of horror, and they celebrated Easter and Christmas. They put stockings up or had self-made artifacts that were appropriate for the season. And I, obviously, I don't have my mind.
This is well. This is obvious. This is the most extraordinary combination of the conventional with the pathological that that you can possibly imagine.
Yes, it is. It has us all theorizing, pulling together information that I believe we know as professionals, and trying to apply them in a situation that is bizarre. Now, here's a point that I made on the stand and that I've made in most public conversations. This kind of an event captures national and world attention, but there are millions of women, for the most part, men as well, who have been abused this way in their own homes. They are essentially held hostage for 10 years, from ages 6 or 7 to 16 or 17. There are pathological tyrants in the household, and they bully, and they sexually abuse. And when I mentioned this months ago, I got such amazing letters from older women, one in her 80s, a couple in their 60s and 70s, saying, thank you, doctor, for letting people know what we lived through. And we're doing all right now. It was the ones who were psychologically healthy who said eventually we had good therapy, we found good partners, but this happens, and it's an extensive and terrible secret. I'm talking about the amount of incest and things that are very close to incest that happen in households across the country.
We're talking with Dr. Frank Ochberg about trauma and his work in the field of trauma, PTSD, Stockholm Syndrome, and related disorders. How did you pick this subject of trauma and healing from trauma to be your life's work?
Well, you know, my 91-year-old aunt just asked me that question yesterday. Turns out when she was young, she was introduced to social work, and she said, that's what I'm going to do with my life. Mark, I never had a clue that things would evolve in this direction. But I was very shaken by the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy back in 1968. I was a resident at Stanford in psychiatry. I was a medical student when President Kennedy was killed, and I think that motivated me to organize my colleagues, to write a book on violence. After a while, I ended up as the psychiatrist on the National Task Force on Terrorism and disorder. And a fellow who became a very good friend of mine represented the FBI. And he had read the book that I wrote when I was really a kid. And he said, "Hey, Frank, we have enough people studying perpetrators. You've got a feel for the victims. That's worth pursuing." And back in the day, there weren't that many who specialized in victims and survivors of violence. It's interesting because we cope in many different ways. We can learn from one another, and actually the outcome is quite good. By and large, the prognosis is positive.
You've suggested that the worst kind of suffering is survivor guilt. Now, with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we must have an increased number of people with that kind of trauma. As a society, Frank, what do we need to do most to help them recover?
First is what we're doing right now. And you may know, Mark, that in the last couple of decades of my life, I've concentrated on working with journalists and help organize international groups of journalists who ask these questions seriously, and they follow the science, and they have the skill to do it well. I think we have to make it part of our national conversation. And I admire the veteran who feels deeply, deeply disturbed that his friend or her friend died and he or she didn't. And they carry that within them. And that's a sign of having an active and a good conscience. And what I end up being friendly as a therapist, but I don't just simply say, "Oh, it wasn't your fault." That doesn't work. I found recently saying to someone in that circumstance, "Well, our job is to make you stronger so that you can carry that burden." You don't want to trivialize the burden of living when somebody died. And you want to help a person become normal, joyful. PTSD takes away your ability to feel love, joy. And for a religious person, it actually takes away the sensation that God loves them. Mm. And if we therapists can understand that and work on how to kindle the capacity for positive feelings, we're doing a good job. Well, you know, we put our own personalities into this, so each of us does it in a somewhat different way.
Frank Ochberg is clinical professor of psychiatry at Michigan State University. It's been great to talk with you, Dr. Ochberg. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now.
Current State's Neighbors in Action series this week takes a look at social work professionals who help children who age out of the foster care system. The St. Vincent Catholic Charities in Lansing offers a long-term residential care program for children aged 5 to 17. Many are abused or neglected. 2 years ago, Michigan extended the foster care age limit from 18 to 21, but those who spend their youth never entering into an adoptive family face special challenges. Tonight, St. Vincent Catholic Charities is hosting a community conversation on aging out of foster care at the Delta Township Library. Here to tell us more is Tamara Johnson, St. Vincent's Community Relations and Marketing Director. Hi, Tamara.
Hi, how are you?
Also, we welcome Dr. John Sita. John is professor in Michigan State University's Department of Social Work and an expert on the topic. He himself is a former foster care child. John, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Do we know how many youth are in foster care at any given time in Michigan, John?
Well, nationally, there's about 20,000. In Michigan, I think there's about 1,500.
And how many of them age out of the system and never get adopted?
Well, any given year, you've got about 600 or so that are aging out. It's going to vary year by year, but typically between 600 and 700 age out of foster care on an annual basis.
Tamara, what particular challenges do these young women and men face when they go out to make their own way in the world? Are they noticeably lacking the TLC that a functioning biological or adoptive a family can provide them?
Yes, a lot of the kids that we see actually coming through our children's home, you know, they've bounced around so much that they're not where they need to be academically in school, and so that obviously affects them when they actually get to the age of 18. You know, they're not ready to go on to a university setting. Some of them haven't even completed high school at that point. Mm-hmm. So we obviously see that result in what kind of jobs that they can obtain, what they're doing as far as reoccurring or obviously seeing those patterns continue that they experienced as younger children as well.
Let's talk about patterns. John Sita, what research have you gathered on people who've aged out of foster care? Are there common patterns?
Well, there are some common patterns, and what we know is that a high percentage of young people who've aged out of foster care suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Many have other health problems like high blood pressure, sexually transmitted diseases, thyroid problems, things like that. We also know that if we put the proper supports in place, we can create resilient, successful young people. The challenge becomes putting the proper supports in place.
What effects have we seen in Michigan since the state raised the foster care age limit from 18 to 21, John?
What effect have we seen? That effect is unknown yet. There isn't any research or evaluation to tell us what's really happening. I think that we intuitively know it's a good thing. But in terms of actual research, that's a bit limited because of the relatively recent change in the policy.
Tamara, what do you see anything at St. Vincent's already?
I think John's right on. You know, the program's so young still right now, and so we're still waiting to see what those impacts will be. We are working with the kids on our level. Obviously, the kids, while they're still in school, we provide the tutors and the mentoring, but obviously we don't see every teen that goes into the foster system here in Michigan, so we have to wait and see what it's going to do.
What life needs does an adult at 21 have who has aged out of the system, Tamara?
I mean, I think they need some kind of mentoring support, somebody that they can turn to. Obviously, as an adult, you are ready to be on your own, but you still do need that person that you can go to for support. So if they could have someone that's just there in their life to provide some kind of care for them would be important.
John, would you care to comment?
Well, what I'll say is it's a good question, but the question assumes that the life needs of foster children are different than kids who grow up in a typical household. I mean, they need belonging, they need unconditional love. They need support, they need boundaries, they need resources. The same thing that my child needs, who's 18 years old and in college. So what we've got to do is recognize the needs are pretty similar. We've got to be more intentional about providing for those resources in a way that makes good sense.
But is it harder to address those needs in an older child than in a younger child?
Oh, harder. I guess it's more challenging, but it can be done. When I left foster care at age 18, I ended up homeless in the streets of East Lansing. And through some support and some resources, I ended up getting a PhD. So it can be done. The question is, do we have the will and the resources to do it?
Tamara, tell us more about how this plays out at St. Vincent.
I mean, I absolutely agree with what John's saying, and I think our staff work very hard to provide some kind of support system to the children or connect them with resources in the community where they can go to when they find themselves aging out of the system. But I do think it's important that we're making sure that we're marketing these opportunities to the kids and making sure that they know they're out there. I think one thing that we find when kids age out of the system, you know, the last thing they want to do is have the state follow them because they've been in the system for so long. So they might not be taking advantage of the Department of Human Services Young Adult Voluntary Foster Care. And so if maybe it takes them a while to go that route, we want to make sure that they have other resources open to them as well.
Frank, if you could change one feature of the landscape here, what would it be? What would you change?
Are you asking me that?
John, I beg your pardon. John?
I thought we had a new caller in the line. I wasn't sure.
I beg your pardon.
No worries. If I could change one thing, I really am not going to answer it because I think there's more than one thing that has to change. Fundamentally, Tamara made a comment a few minutes ago I think is well worth repeating. These young people need mentors. They need someone who is irrationally crazy about them, like I am my own daughter and the rest of you are your own children. And so that's the biggest challenge we face.
Tamara, you're shaking, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's really levels to it. You know, I think we need to address some issues with the education and moving the children around before they even reach the age of 18, as well as putting those programs in place after they age out. So I think we really have to look at the whole span as a whole and really look at, I mean, obviously, as we would any child that's still in the home with their parents, they're getting certain things at the age of 16 and 17 that they're also getting at 18 that we really need to take into consideration for foster care children as well.
We'll remind our listeners that St. Vincent Catholic Charities hosts a community conversation on aging out of foster care at the Delta Township Library. Tonight, we want to thank our guests, Tamara Johnson, St. Vincent's Community Relations and Marketing Director, and Dr. John Sita, professor in Michigan State University's Department of Social Work and an expert on this topic. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care and good luck. Bye-bye.
And our Neighbors in Action is always looking for more nominations. We know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work. We would like to know about them. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do.
Is Elder Grant. It's a book about America a long, long time ago. It has so many awesome parts. You simply won't believe how much this book can change your life.
The 2013-14 season at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts kicks into high gear this month. As always, there's something for everyone at the Wharton's East Lansing venues. WKAR's Peter Wharf joins Executive Director Mike Brand for a quick look at the upcoming season, starting their chat with a Broadway sensation.
Well, we could start with the Book of Mormon, since that's one of the biggest hit Broadway shows of this decade, and that's going to be on our Broadway season next season, the MSU Federal Credit Union season, and it's actually going to be at the end of the season in June 2014.
Is it common to see shows that are so successful and of such notoriety hit the road so early on?
Well, I think over the last few years, producers of hit shows like Wicked, Lion King, and now the Book of Mormon are pretty much experienced in how to produce and cross the North American continent. So Book of Mormon, all during its first big hit year in New York, its first season, looked at a strategy that was very conservative, not with real big eyes, but with a view of maximizing ticket sales by doing shorter runs in every city. So they put together a production which is now running in New York for a number of years at a complete sellout, of course. And there's a sit-down production in Chicago, and we're part of the first national touring company, which will be here. It's opened up this in the middle of this year, and is doing some of the bigger cities. And we're in the route here in the first year that it's touring cities, you know, maybe two, possibly three cities each month.
Mamma Mia is a fun and popular show. That comes to the Broadway series. Talk about that and a couple of the others that are coming to your Broadway series in 13-14.
Well, Mamma Mia comes back to most major performing arts centers every 4 or 5 years, and so this is our interval to bring that back. Beauty and the Beast was also a huge hit here in East Lansing. It was part of the first national touring company, I believe, in the late 1990s, and it's the first time it's coming back since then. So we are are very excited to see that great Disney production back here.
Can we get into some of the classical headlines? I was thrilled as a string player to see that Yo-Yo Ma will be returning to the Wharton Center.
Right. He's he's one of these artists that doesn't really do a lot of solo touring. He does do appearances with major orchestras around the world. And his Silk Road project is it tours a little bit, I think, every year, every other year. But we were lucky enough to get on his agenda for his solo recital tour. And so he'll be on the season next year, as well as two orchestras that don't do a lot of U.S. national touring. The St. Petersburg Philharmonic does New York appearances in Los Angeles, I think, on a very regular basis, but it doesn't kind of get all the connecting cities in between. So we're part of that tour.
It is thrilling to see the St. Petersburg Philharmonic. It's really one of those Eastern European orchestras of virtuoso players. Rachel York is coming. Tell me about her and what we can expect to hear in November.
Well, our audiences here in Central Michigan have seen Rachel in a number of Broadway productions that we've presented here. Last year, she was here as our guest for our donor concert, announcing our season. Then she turned around and starred in Anything Goes, which opened our season that we're just finishing this year. She's a resident artist that year, so part of her time is on the stage and part of her time is going to be in the MSU, Federal Credit Union Institute for Arts and Creativity. So she's doing education activity here in a recital in the Payson Theater, and then she'll be on our series at the Traverse City Opera House when she's finished here at the Wharton Center.
More classical music at the Wharton Center includes a Christmas tradition that you see on concert series across the country. They haven't been here in a little over a decade, though. Happy to see the Vienna Boys Choir returning for Christmas in Vienna in December.
That's right. We are on their Christmas tour this year. They come to the United States doing regular repertoire during most parts of the year, depending on how it fits into their schedule in Europe. This year, they also added a late November and most of December Christmas tour, which we were able to fit in on their tour. So we're very happy to have them back at the Wharton Center. They were here a number of times over our 32 years, and I think it's been an absence of about 10 or 12 years since they've been here doing this this Christmas in Vienna performance.
Talking with Mike Brand, Executive Director of the Wharton Center for Performing Arts here at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Mike, the season opens with Diana Krall and continues with the Newport Jazz Festival in terms of jazz performances and beyond. Can you talk about jazz at the Wharton Center?
Well, Diana Krall is going to be our season opener, and of course she's got this new hit album out and a huge world tour, which we are a part of. And the tour and the album are the Ragdoll World Tour, Glad Ragdoll World Tour. And so we're very excited to be on her agenda opening in late September. The Newport Jazz Festival 60 Now Tour celebrates their 60th anniversary of the Newport Jazz Festival. And it's got a very stunning lineup, as well as we have the young French artist Cyril Amy here with her band, doing a Michigan tour here in the west side of the state and up in Traverse City. So it's a nice, diverse lineup of artists for the jazz series this year.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me.
A classic and a Tony Award-winning play coming to theater at Wharton with Shakespeare and more.
That's right. We have the acting company doing something a little different that we're kind of following what a lot of resident theaters around the country do. And we're going to have them come here on a Saturday in February, February 15th. They're going to do two different plays the same day, a 3 o'clock and an 8 o'clock production. The afternoon production is William Shakespeare's Hamlet, and then Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And in between, audience members have a chance to buy a box lunch here served in the Chrisman Lounge. And kind of have a day at theater at the Wharton Center.
Mike Brand is Executive Director of the Wharton Center for Performing Arts at Michigan State University here in East Lansing. Mike, thanks for a look at the 2013-14 season.
Thank you, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, what's involved in signing up for the health care exchanges that are part of the Affordable Care Act? We'll take a look. Also, a look at all the new exhibits opening at East Lansing's Broad Art Museum. That and more tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Take care.